Okay, I believe we are live on Zoom and on Facebook Live. Let me welcome everyone again to this Partners for Progressive Israel webinar, the Palestinian Political Arena. Where do things stand? What lies ahead? I want to say hello to everyone who is in the US, in Palestine, in Israel, and other places around the world. This is the latest installment of Partners for Progressive Israel's Conversations with Israel and Palestine. My name is Ron Skolnick. I organize these webinars on behalf of Partners for Progressive Israel. Conversations is a series of informational webinars that bring voices from Israel and Palestine to an American and international audience. And we seek to provide an important link between progressives in the Middle East and those in the US and around the world. In a moment, I'm going to hand it over to Dr. Dana Greenwald, today's discussion moderator. I'll just note, for those who don't know, Partners for Progressive Israel is an American not-for-profit. It's dedicated to the achievement of a durable and just peace between Israel and its neighbors. That includes an end to Israel's occupation based on a two-state solution. Partners supports Israelis working to ensure social justice, civil rights, and equality for all of Israel's inhabitants. The organization cultivates Jewish-Arab partnerships and seeks to deepen Americans' understanding of Israel's and Palestine's complexities so they can better advocate for a progressive future for all the inhabitants of the region. Now, Partners is bringing you this webinar for free and delighted to do so. But if you enjoyed and want more programming, please visit progressiveisrael.org and make a contribution. And I'll just note before introducing today's panel that for the coming month, it's an excellent opportunity to help Partners for Progressive Israel. Partners has received a matching grant to support its efforts to rally attention around the dispossession and displacement of Palestinians, be that in Sheikh Jarrah, Silwan, the villages of the Southern Hebron Hills and elsewhere, and whether that's through evictions, home demolitions, settler violence, denial of access to running water and other measures. I'll drop the relevant link in the chat in a few minutes if you wish to contribute. So now let me swing over to today's discussion and I'll briefly introduce today's panelists and I'll put their fuller bios in the chat just so we can get to the discussion more quickly. First, Dr. Dana Greenwald, who moderate today, is an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at the City College of New York. Dr. Greenwald's research focuses on the politics of the Middle East with a particular focus on Palestinian politics, as well as on nationalism, conflict, and state building. Dr. Greenwald obtained her PhD in political science from the University of Michigan, and her writing has appeared in the National Interest, The Washington Post's Monkey Cage, Foreign Policy, and 972 Magazine. Dr. Khalil Jashan is a Palestinian-American political analyst and media commentator. He serves as executive director of the Arab Center, Washington, DC. Previously, Dr. Jashan served as executive vice president of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee and director of its government affairs affiliate, the National Association of Arab Americans. He has also served on boards of directors and advisory boards of several Middle East-oriented organizations, including ANERA, Miftah, and Search for Common Ground. Dr. Jashan appears regularly as a political commentator on Arab and American media outlets. Last, but certainly not least, Dr. Khalil Shakaki is a professor of political science. He's director of the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research based in Ramallah, Palestine. Since 2005, he's been a senior fellow at the Crown Center for Middle East Studies at Brandeis University. And since 1993, Dr. Shakaki has conducted more than 200 polls among Palestinians in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And since 2000, dozens of joint polls among Palestinians and Israelis. His research focuses on the peace process, Palestinian state building, public opinion, transition to democracy, and the impact of domestic Palestinian politics on the peace process. So it's really a wonderful, wonderful panel who've agreed to take part today. With no further ado, let me hand it over to Dr. Dana Greenwald, and I'll rejoin you at the end of the broadcast to close things up. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Ron, for the introduction and also to Partners for Progressive Israel for inviting me to moderate this event. I'm really honored to be sharing the stage with my esteemed co-panelists here So as Ron mentioned, I'm going to be the moderator today, and I'm going to be keeping track of time, which is why I'm just setting my clock right now. So we're going to begin the discussion. I'll be posing the questions to Dr. Jashan and Dr. Shikaki for about 40 minutes, and then we'll open it up for Q&A from the audience. And the way that the Q&A works is you are going to type any questions you have at any time during the discussion in the Q&A box at the bottom of your screen. So please feel free to go ahead and use that at any time to type your questions. The last 20 minutes of our time here will be open to audience Q&A. So at about 1:10 or so, we will open up for that. So I wanted to kind of introduce the discussion and frame it a little bit. Obviously, discussing the Palestinian political arena gives us a really broad mandate for this 1 hour panel. And I was just, thinking through with the panelists here how to frame it. And I think one important thing to acknowledge is that the Palestinian population is large and diverse. We're talking about over 13 million Palestinians globally, nearly half of whom live within Israel and the occupied territories. So that includes over 3 million in the West Bank, inclusive of East Jerusalem, about 2 million in Gaza, about 2 million inside Israel within its 1949 boundaries, and an additional 6 to 7 million Palestinians abroad. Of course, the Palestinian political arena, therefore, is taking place. Palestinian politics is taking place all over the world, in a sense, because of the shared experience of this population of statelessness, of diasporization, and the fact that millions of these Palestinians are multi-generational refugees as well. So we have Palestinian politics taking place under a variety of territories, countries, state structures, Palestinians themselves having varied access to rights, basic goods and services, and security. But of course, what they share, perhaps with the partial exclusion of those who are inside Israel proper and citizens, is they share this exclusion from full citizenship, its full set of rights, and thus the ability to truly, really stay and belong in their homeland. So when we look at just Israel and the occupied territories itself, we're looking at a situation now where we have almost probably parity between the Jewish Israeli and the Palestinian Arab populations, each of which are hovering around 7 million within this land. And so that's the context that we're working within and we're exploring today. And I wanted to kind of pose the first question to get us started to Dr. Jashan. So I wanted to start, if possible, Dr. Jashan, with kind of a bird's eye view for our listeners. For many outside observers, those of us outside Palestine, we see what's going on, and it seems like things have been stuck for a long time. There's been, of course, major events that have punctuated the ongoing conflict, the ongoing occupation. Depending how far back we go, we can look at the creation of the Palestine Palestinian Authority as one of those major events, two major intifadas, the 2006 Palestinian elections and a subsequent split between the West Bank and Gaza under Fatah-led rule and Hamas-led rule, respectively, and waves of periodic deadly violence, of course, in which Israeli military offensives against Gaza since then have killed thousands and left thousands displaced and leveled critical infrastructure in that territory. So as someone who's been kind of participating in and observing Palestinian politics for so many years, how would you characterize the current mood within the Palestinian national struggle or the Palestinian liberation movement? Are things truly stuck? If not, where do you see signs of kind of movement?
Thank you, Diana. That's a very important question, although it's a very convoluted and very comprehensive question in a way. So we should be out of here by the end of the month, if you don't mind. I'm just kidding. Thank you first to Partners for Progressive Israel. Thank you, Ron, for your kind introduction. It is an honor and a pleasure to participate in this conversation with Diana and with my good friend Khalil Shikaki. In response to the question, I would say, if I'm to describe the status of Palestinian politics today, I would say we are in the post-Oslo paralysis period. First, my first advice to our audience is, in looking and trying to understand Palestinian politics, it's very important to avoid taking a static approach to that. I think Diana just hinted at that. It's not just the size and the diversity of the population, but there is a certain internal dynamics to Palestinian politics that is often ignored by the parties, including mediating parties, and by the media. Somehow, in a protracted conflict like the Palestine question, the tendency is always to simplify things and talk about Palestinian public opinion or Palestinian politics, as if this Palestinian politics is static. It's not changing. It's actually a process, and process in the making, an undefined process, because it's a protracted, unresolved conflict. So if I were to arbitrarily divide Palestinian politics into some kind of a framework, some like put them in a different phases, I would say that the Palestinians went through a basic stage one, 1948 to 1967, where they were classified and dealt with as refugees. The emphasis of their politics was on rectifying the injustice done to them, on returning home. That's why, jokingly, I refer to this period sometimes as the ET phase, I want to go home phase of Palestinian politics. 67 to 72 is when the Palestinians began to realize that they have to take matters into their own hands. So that was the period of toying with armed struggle. And I say toying because, frankly, personally, I don't think the Palestinians really took seriously armed struggle. And that's maybe why it wasn't very successful. But that's the period when the emphasis of Palestinian politics was on liberation, was on forming a representative to represent them internationally and with Israel. And that's the period where the PLO was formed or was born. The next phase was a 73 to 87, and that's essentially the toying with a solution phase for the Palestinians. That's the beginning to explore the idea of a two-state solution, of a political compromise, if you will, and ending with the first intifada that became, in a way, the father and the mother of the so-called peace process or peace negotiations. A process that we began to see between 88 and 93, with 88, the U.S. beginning to deal directly with the Palestinians, the PLO, and a peace negotiations process was proposed that resulted in the Oslo, although, despite its dismal performance and results, but nonetheless, that characterized the politics of the period. Beyond that, 94 and to 2000, I would say the fifth phase of Palestinian politics is the transformation of the PLO into the PNA. The PLO deteriorated quickly into a PPLO, which is part of Palestine Liberation Organization, unplanned, but that's essentially what happened. And then it was even reduced further to a local PNA, Palestine National Authority, based in Ramallah, and it tended to kind of overshadow, if you will, to the PLO. And all that led us to this now sixth or seventh period in Palestinian politics, the post-Oslo paralysis. And the Palestinians have been trying for the past 20 years, essentially, to adjust to the failure of the Oslo process, because they kind of bet their struggle on that process, and unfortunately, it imploded. It did not produce the intended results, and therefore, it ended up in this paralysis. So what you have to deal with here to understand Palestinian politics is the dispersion that Diana referred to earlier with the numbers, because we're talking about half of the Palestinians being under Israeli control, whether in Israel itself, the 2 million, or whether in the West Bank and Gaza, the 5 plus million, so about 7+ million Palestinians there. You're talking about the 2 million in Israel proper. You're talking about Jordan having the largest Palestinian diaspora of about 2.3 million. You're talking about essentially additional distribution in 500,000 in Syria, 500,000 in Chile, almost 500,000 in Lebanon, and so on. So clearly, the Palestinians are under different jurisdictions. So their politics cannot be uniform. For those who are puzzled, why can't the Palestinian unite and have a uniform politics that make it easy for me to understand? I'm sorry, life did not promise us easy understanding, particularly of convoluted and protracted conflicts like the Palestine question, that today has to translate the three Ds that the Palestinians live under: the dispersion, the division, and the discrimination that they face in all these geographic areas where they are. So Palestinian politics has reached, in a way, this paralysis based on these both geographic and political functions. And the Palestinian struggle for self-determination and statehood is definitely stuck, the word that Diana used in her early remarks, because you see a lot of experts always refer to it as the Palestinians have hit a brick wall. Frankly, it's a bit more complicated. I'm not kind of being a comic here, but hitting a brick wall really, you kind of get probably a shock. You might get a scar on your forehead, but you tend to realize that's the end of the road. You hit a brick wall. I think the Palestinian situation is worse than that. I think the Palestinians have hit a cul-de-sac. A cul-de-sac is different. You keep moving and you get the impression that you're getting somewhere, but you aren't. And you didn't have the luxury of hitting a brick wall to wake you up. So the Palestinians keep thinking they're stuck in this desert mirage. There is this semblance of moving, that they are getting somewhere, that maybe next year would be better. Maybe the next American president would be better. Maybe the next Israeli prime minister would be better. And they are not getting anywhere. They are still within that political cul-de-sac. And that's why I refer to this stage as initially a stage of paralysis. So what was proposed in the earlier phases of the peace negotiations processes that we went through, what was suggested as a transitional phase to basically end this kind of almost permanent occupation, unfortunately, it has deteriorated to today, where we essentially have the Palestinian leadership in the form of the PA that has lost momentum. It has replaced the PLO. Practically, it hasn't been able to fit in its shoes, and it has become, instead of as initially hoped, an agent of change. It became the guardian of the status quo. So it has become the gatekeeper and the guarantor of Israeli occupation, of Israeli security, because it doesn't have an option. It has allowed itself to become captive to Israeli occupation, and its survival depends on it. So that's essentially how I perceive personally the current phase of Palestinian politics. Diana.
Thank you so much for this comprehensive overview, and also giving us some pretty evocative metaphors and imagery for thinking about the present situation. So to turn things to Dr. Shekeki now, I wanna give you a chance, Dr. Shekeki, of course, to build on and elaborate on any of the analogies and the analysis we just heard. But I was also hoping you could, drawing on your expertise in public opinion, give us kind of a sense of, within that context that Dr. Jashan just laid out, what kinds of trends or developments are you seeing in Palestinian attitudes in the West Bank and Gaza? As you know, earlier this year, the Palestinian Authority suspended potentially indefinitely a set of elections that had been planned for the presidency and for the legislature within the PA, and supposedly as well for the PNC within the PLO. But for many of these kind of most important developments we've seen in the Palestinian public sphere in the past 6 months, protests around the threatened expulsions and the ongoing evictions in Sheikh Jarrah, in Silwan, the outbreak of conflict between Hamas and Israel once again, and the devastation that this war wrought on Gaza, the Gilboa prison outbreak, these things make the Palestinian Authority itself, and maybe even the PLO, seem almost irrelevant to kind of the trends and currents of the day in Palestinian politics. So is that what you're observing? Is that an accurate read? Or what sorts of other trends or developments are you seeing in Palestinian political attitudes in the current environment?
Thank you, Leanne, and thank you, Ron, for the introduction. And it's a pleasure to be with all of you. I think Khalil have already given us a very broad and overview of where things are. For the answer to the question about public opinion, I would only perhaps summarize where I see things characterizing attitudes or influencing attitudes. The three broad things that I think are relevant here that would characterize the situation today is the division, because of the impact, the direct impact it has on public attitudes regarding both the domestic scene and Israeli-Palestinian relations. The second is the bad governance under the PA. In recent years, the trends in Palestinian politics have become more and more authoritarian. This is clearly a very fundamental transformation for the Palestinians, and it too has significant impact on attitudes. And thirdly, it is more the dysfunctional relationship with the state of Israel, the lack of political process that promises to get the Palestinians and the Israelis somewhere. So these are the three main characteristics of where the Palestinians are today that has the direct impact on Palestinians who live in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Now, in the first response for the Palestinians to all of these, of course, is to demand from their authority certain changes. These demands have not changed over the years. What has changed has been the expectations of the Palestinian public. For example, unity, unification of the West Bank and Gaza, reconciliation between Fatah and Hamas has been a top priority of the Palestinian public. But over the years, given the failure after failure in producing unity and reconciliation, we have seen expectations plummeting. And we have seen attitudes shifting in terms of who is responsible for this. Is it Hamas? Is it Fatah? Is it Abbas? And so there is significant change in this regard. And today, there is no doubt that most Palestinians blame the president and Fatah for the lack of unity. While in the past, the blame was squarely put on Hamas for that. Most Palestinians punish the Palestinian leadership for this and for other failures that I'll come to later or perhaps in future questions. On the other matters like governance, for example, we also see a great deal of stability in terms of attitudes regarding democracy, regarding liberal values. Most Palestinians, particularly the youth, tend to be very liberal. In terms of political values and even some social values. We do see significant support for gender equality among Palestinians compared to other Arabs in the region. There is no doubt that the Palestinians do show significant attachment to liberal social values. But when asked to evaluate the status of Palestinian democracy over the years, we see significant change and fluctuations. The trend, however, is very clear. most Palestinians no longer believe that they have a democracy or that the current political elite within the Palestinian Authority is capable of producing democracy. Most Palestinians believe that the old guard of the Palestinian National Movement are anti-democrat and that there is little opportunity for democracy under the leadership of the old guard. There's no doubt if you ask them today to tell you whether they have liberal, they have free press, 80% or more will say no. This is also true with regard to independence of the judiciary, pluralism in civil society, etc. So there's a very, very dim view today of Palestinian governance that is prevailing among the Palestinians. On the third issue, that is the issue of Israeli-Palestinian relations, we've seen a significant change over the years. In the mid-90s, you would say that this was the golden era for peacemaking. Attitudes have consolidated around the idea of a two-state solution, diplomacy and negotiations is the most effective means of getting us there, and trusting the Palestinian leadership negotiating such a deal. This was the attitude in the mid-90s after Oslo. Today, most of that has vanished. Support for the two-state solution today is just a minority. I do, however, need to point out that despite that, support for the two-state solution remains the views of most. That is, we don't see a competing paradigm being offered by anybody, including the one-staters. Support for the two-state solution received today, based on our most recent survey in last month, 36%. This is the lowest we have ever recorded. Compare that to 80 or 85% in the mid-90s. You can see the change. Even 10 years ago, you could still find 70% in favor. Now it's just about half of that. We have also seen shifts in support for violence. Today, there is significant rise in support for violence. It's not a majority, but compare again to where we were in the mid-90s. There is significant change in the mid-90s. You could hardly find a fifth of the Palestinians in favor of violence, believing that if Palestinians resorted to armed struggle, that this would help them achieve their national rights. Today, almost half of the Palestinians believe that. Again, this is a reflection of what I described earlier as a dysfunctional relationship with the state of Israel, as most Palestinians believe they have no Israeli partner that is interested in reaching a peace agreement with the Palestinians based on a two-state solution or a one-state solution for that matter. So these are the overall attitudes and trends that we see among the Palestinians regarding the issues of internal politics, Israeli-Palestinian relations. You've mentioned the question of elections. Clearly, there is significant demand among the Palestinians for holding elections. But if you ask the Palestinians, do you think elections are about to take place anytime soon, the answer is no. If you ask the Palestinians, was it the right call to cancel or postpone the elections? Again, you'll find a two-thirds or more, even up to three-quarters will say no. Was the president right? Was the president sincere in postponing the elections because of the Jerusalem issue that he claimed was the reason? Again, most Palestinians will say, of course not. He was afraid of the result. So there is little trust in the president today. In fact, based on our most recent survey, 78%, almost 80% of the Palestinians said the president must resign. This is, again, the lowest point in which we see the level of trust between the president and the Palestinian public. I'll stop here. I have a lot more to say, but I'm going to leave until perhaps further discussion.
Thank you, Dr. Shakaki. I think you know, I'll actually continue with you on the next question, but Dr. Jashan, I'll move immediately to you to also respond to my next question. I am sort of torn about whether to take the discussion a little bit more towards what's going on with the PA and Hamas versus the current Israeli government, and the area that Dr. Shakaki just raised of this kind of lack of any kind of hope in the Israeli partner, or any idea that the Israeli government is going to actually promote any dramatic change in the status quo. So I would put forward on that note this question about what you're seeing in terms of the current coalition government in Israel, with the Bennett-led government's approach to the occupation and settlements and the conflict in general. It seems from most observers that what they're doing is largely divorced from kind of the reality that you all have described so eloquently, that the political realities that Palestinians are facing and the social and economic realities that they're facing on the ground. We do see, you know, the Israeli government pursuing sort of piecemeal policies to, quote unquote, shrink the conflict, to cite this influential thinker, Micah Goodman, who seems to have the ear of Prime Minister Bennett. So small scale reforms, you know, increasing the number of permits for Palestinians in Gaza to go into Israel to work, approving the legal status of Palestinians in the West Bank who have been, you know, who have relocated their residency years ago from Gaza, really small sort of concrete but small policies. Do you see any hope? I'll go to Dr. Shakaki first and then Dr. Jashan, that there will be any more transformative policies to come out of this government? Or should we expect just kind of more of the same in terms of these more or less unilateral, small, piecemeal steps that don't really address the fundamental realities of the occupation and ongoing discrimination that we see? So Dr. Shakaki, feel free to jump in first, and then we'll go to Dr. Jashan. And also, I'm told to remind, let me just say quickly to the audience, please do drop your questions at any time in the Q&A box. Dr. Shakaki.
There is no doubt that for most Palestinians, the current Israeli government is even worse than the previous government of Netanyahu. At least on paper, the previous government was willing to accept or claim to accept the two-state solution as a paradigm to resolve the conflict, and in fact was engaged in serious negotiations under the US administration in 13 and 14 to try and see if a deal to end the conflict was feasible. On this issue of what is the ultimate preferable solution to end the conflict and how to get there, this current Israeli government is more hardline than the previous government. This essentially leaves the Palestinian Authority without a purpose. The goal of the creation of the authority is to deliver a state through diplomacy and negotiations. This Israeli government says, well, thank you, no, but we're not interested in that. So it basically undercuts everything that this PA is trying to achieve. On the second element of its policy, and that is the settlement construction, we clearly see that this government is not only continuing, but in fact is moving forward in significant manners. Look at the last 2 months, you can see progress on some of the major settlement initiatives, that decisive settlement initiatives. These initiatives, if and when completely implemented, will basically destroy any prospect for future Israeli-Palestinian peace along the lines of the two-state solution, from the E1 to the settlements to the south of Jerusalem, to settlements to the north of Jerusalem. There is no doubt, without getting into the details, that the slow movement that we currently see with regard to settlement plans that these indeed are to go unchecked. And we currently do not see much attempt by the Americans or the international community to try and stop that. Put that on top of what I've said earlier about lack of any framework for or means of resolving the conflict. And what you end up with is what you refer to as shrinking the conflict. Although I'm not going to underestimate the importance of families having their IDs or laborers being able to work and find jobs in Israel. And I must tell you that for most Palestinians, there is indeed support for measures that would improve the daily living conditions of the Palestinians. But if that is to be the approach that would replace a serious political process, then in few years, there isn't really going to be much to talk about in terms of resolving the conflict through diplomacy and a two-state solution, and reality on the ground will indeed be very different. And in the meanwhile, the ability of the Palestinian Authority to maintain the trust or to earn the trust of the Palestinians will, of course, evaporate. The efforts by the Israelis to, under pressure from the international community, to try and strengthen the Palestinian Authority and weaken Hamas isn't likely to work unless there is a viable political process underway. And this Israeli government doesn't really leave much room for that to take place. And that is going to be detrimental to future Israeli-Palestinian relations, as well as the viability of the Palestinian Authority itself.
Great. So I turn to Dr. Jashan to see if you share similarly, maybe pessimistic is the wrong word, maybe realistic view of the current Israeli government and its approach. And then also, if you will, speak a little bit, Dr. Jashan, when you've responded to some of these issues that Dr. Shirkaki has raised, about the U.S.'s role here, because that was the next issue that I wanted to turn to with our remaining time in the moderated discussion. So, you know, if you could give us your perspective on the position of, you know, the Biden administration and current trends within the U.S. political space towards Palestine, if we're seeing any kind of room for maneuver from this U.S. administration in terms of advancing a more progressive approach to Palestinian issues, or if you think it's going to be more or less kind of more of the same from the current U.S. administration. So I'll give you both issue areas to turn to, both the Israeli government and the Biden administration.
Thank you, Diana. Let me link what I mentioned earlier with regards to describing, if you will, the current phase of Palestinian politics as one of post-Oslo paralysis. By paralysis, I did not necessarily mean that the Palestinian people have lost their hope. And I want to link that to what Khalil just mentioned based on his excellent polling in Palestinian society, that the Palestinian public is frustrated, yes. It's disillusioned, yes. But it hasn't despaired totally. It is changing its expectation. It is, in other words, to put it in social science sorcery terminology, what we are seeing in Palestine is the ultimate frustration of rising expectations. Palestinian expectations have not been met. And you have to pay a price for that. Somehow, this is being dismissed by many Israelis. It's being dismissed by many Americans as if nothing is going to happen. But what this frustration has produced is essentially a pressure cooker that is under intense fire or over intense fire. And it's apt to explode sooner or later. And where it leads, nobody knows. And especially in the absence of credible, leadership in Palestine with a vision and with initiative. So it's a very dangerous situation. With regards to the shrinking the conflict, which has become the cute kind of creative kind of plan by the current government, the Bennett government in Israel. Frankly, I'll tell you this. I mean, from my experience, I remember from childhood days, growing up as an Israeli citizen in the 48 Palestinian areas occupied in 48 and growing up as a citizen, I have seen quite a few people try to do this shrinking of the conflict under different terminology over the years. This is not new. Ben-Gurion did it. Begin did it. Moshe Sharet did it. Yigal Alon did it. All of them attempted to shrink the conflict with their own different formulas. So this is not new. And frankly, this has been an attempt from the very beginning to try to reduce the Palestine conflict to a lower integer, if you want to use a mathematical term, in order to eliminate the conflict as if it's going to disappear. And it's a slippery slope, frankly. Even some of us on the Palestinian side are prone to kind of drift in that direction, in that analysis. And definitely some of the progressives among our colleagues here in the States and in the Jewish community and so on. Because when you see it, you know, I mean, all of a sudden, Palestine becomes West Bank and Gaza. West Bank and Gaza becomes only 30 or 40% of what originally was promised. Gaza is out of the equation. Then the conflict has recently been redefined into Jerusalem. Jerusalem has been reduced now to Sheikh Jarrah. I mean, where is the conflict? Where is Palestine? My problem is, with all due respect, is not Sheikh Jarrah, and it's not equality. It's not like, you know, ending discrimination. My problem is Palestine. And unless we, in a protracted conflict, stop this tendency to kind of keep reducing it, reducing the ceiling lower and lower and lower in order to eliminate the conflict, we're not going to get there. And what is being proposed in terms of shrinking the conflict is nothing better or worse than the Kushner plan. It is the Kushner plan revisited. It's the deal of the century all over again. So it's not surprising at all when my colleague and friend Khalil described the situation in Palestine, looking at the new Israeli government or the current Israeli government as worse than its predecessor. It's based on that. No to peace, no to negotiations, no to meeting with the Palestinians, no to Palestinian statehood, but let's make your life a little easier. My problem is not the difficulty. Palestinian life has been difficult for hundreds of years, going back to the Ottoman Empire. That's not the issue. The issue is political. The issue is self-determination. The issue is statehood. So unless we go back to this issue, I think we're not going to get closer to any normalcy or any peace for either side of this conflict.
Okay, thank you both so much. And I think we're at the time where we should turn now to some of the questions that have been coming in from the audience. So I am going to kind of combine some of these together. And I think there's one thread that's running through a few of these questions, which is, you know, what can we do or what can Palestinians do more specifically that would be most likely to create significant change towards a resolution? We had a few questions along that line saying, okay, so are we kind of stuck with the status quo forever, or where do each of you see possibilities for promoting a change in the current situation? So that's one broad kind of set of questions we see. There's also a question also kind of broadly about Palestinian public opinion, in a sense. How strong is anti-normalization, quote unquote, anti-normalization among Palestinians in their different locations? And what is its significance? Is it possible to work beyond ethno-nationalism to build a culturally plural society in Israel and Palestine? So these are a couple questions that we can start with, and then we'll come into some other more specific questions about the PA. But why don't we go first, if you're ready, Dr. Shikaki, maybe to think about the first couple of questions here of, are we stuck in the status quo, or where do you see possibilities for Palestinians to transform the situation or others?
I do see Palestinians continuing to make demands of their own authority to clean up its acts. I don't expect these demands to succeed, but I do expect the Palestinians to continue to make them. There is no doubt that some of the behavior of the Palestinian Authority in recent months, particularly with the cancellation of elections, the killing of Nizar Banat, the political activist, and the treatment of the demonstrations that followed that. These were things that have seen significant public responses to them that have indicated very clearly to that the Palestinian Authority is isolated from the Palestinian public, and that the gap between the leadership and the masses is widening significantly. Is this going to have an impact on the Palestinian leadership? At this point, I'm not optimistic. I think there are things that the international community can do, both in terms of its own relationship with the Palestinian Authority and in its own relationship with the State of Israel, that I think might be helpful to help those Palestinians who are currently trying to get things changed in their environment. There is no doubt that the Palestinian Authority is essentially funded by the international community. International community is funding, therefore, bad governance, whether they like it or not. They can claim that is not their intention, but that ultimately is precisely what is the outcome of their own policies. They do need to make it very clear that this is not the kind of governance that they want, and they need to be a lot more critical of the Palestinian Authority publicly, and to basically demonstrate to the Palestinian leadership that their policies, that these policies are unacceptable. And in the long run, the international community will not be able to continue to fund a corrupt and authoritarian political system. For the State of Israel, I think the international community needs to make clearly, in the same manner, its own policies. Clearly, this Israeli government is not interested in a two-state solution. It's not interested in letting the Palestinians go and create their own independent and sovereign Palestinian state. The international community must confront Israel with a choice. It should tell Israel that there are two possibilities: either let the Palestinians go as independent and sovereign state, or grant them equal rights, that there is no third alternative. If the international community wants to make a difference, I think this is where they need to start, with the Palestinian Authority and with the State of Israel. Their policies regarding the Palestinian Authority and Israel should then flow from the responses that they receive from both sides regarding these issues, to continue to support current policies, or not necessarily support, but to tolerate the status quo, is essentially to contribute in its resilience. And that is certainly make it extremely difficult for those Palestinians who are struggling right now to create a better future for themselves, both against their own authority and against the State of Israel. That is where I think what can be done in terms of what we should be doing, what the Israelis should be doing again, as well on their own side, and what the international community needs to do.
Thanks, Dr. Jashan.
I agree that the current state of Palestinian governance is untenable, and that it cannot continue as it is. Unfortunately, when you look at the historical pattern requiring, if you will, international intervention that Khalil alluded to, that never happened short of violence in Palestine. Really, when you look at historical pattern, whether it's Intifada II or Intifada I or whatever, there has to be some movement in the Palestinian street that is threatening to American interests and threatening to Israel's existence before there is a serious move by a US administration to intervene in a constructive way. It is unfortunate, but that's what the price we have to pay for a pattern, a precedent that we have set, the U.S. and the international community that we have set. So it's up to the Palestinians to take matters into their own hands at one point and decide if they want to stay under this untenable condition or they want to nudge things. And if they want to nudge things, they know what they need to do. Let me move quickly just to the American side, because I think Khalil expressed and I agree with him totally, what needs to be done on the Palestinian side in terms of the continuing pressure on the leadership to deliver, even though both of us are not very optimistic currently that these demands will be met. But eventually they will have to. Eventually they will have to. In terms of the U.S., unfortunately, I think short of the symbolic gestures that this administration has voiced since, let's say, the campaign and since assuming power in Washington are fine as symbolic gestures. But will they contribute to solving the Palestine question? Will they bring about peace between Israelis and Palestinians? I doubt it very much. Because frankly, this return to peace processing in the Middle East without a solid goal of ending occupation and creating a Palestinian state, which the administration is right now playing games, kind of alluding to it as equating Palestinian and Israeli desire for peace and living in dignity. I don't know what dignity is politically. I can't take it to the bank. I mean, I fully understand culturally what it means, and I know both sides need it. But politically speaking, that is not the platform of a superpower. The platform of a superpower should be what was expressed, I think, this morning in Haaretz by Daniel Sokach. The harsh truth, Biden needs to tell Israelis now about their future. And for those who are interested on what needs to be done, particularly from a Jewish and an Israeli perspective, please go back to Haaretz and take a look at Daniel's piece today in terms of what he proposes for Biden to do. Because what Biden is doing, I know Biden very well. I've dealt with him as a senator. On one occasion, actually, I had a closed door debate with him in front of a Jewish audience that was trying to create a progressive lobby in this country, and he wasn't totally briefed about it. He came with a traditional pro-APAC speech at the time. I remember that, and he embarrassed himself quite visibly. But there are issues that are needed for peace that he is uncomfortable doing. You know, he's willing to sit down and talk to us about his dad and his commitment to Zionism, and secondhand smoke damage from Golda Meir that he sustained from meeting her too often. Whatever it is, it's fine. But that doesn't solve the Palestine problem. If the good intentions declared thus far by this administration required moral and political leadership that he hasn't shown thus far. Is he overwhelmed by the pandemic and other things? Yes, he is. But this is an important issue. It is an important issue for the survival of both the Palestinian state and the Israeli state. And if he supposedly is so committed to both, to peace, then he needs to nudge things and begin. He hasn't begun to work on this issue in spite of the good intentions declared.
Thank you. I think the next cluster of questions that I want to address here has to do with the PA. So if we can bounce back to that, there are a few questions along the lines of, do we expect that given the historic, in many ways, protests that Dr. Shafaki has mentioned that we saw in reaction to the murder of Nizar Banat, given the kind of mobilization we've just seen over the spring and summer, is there any, you know, chance that the Palestinian leadership and the PA itself will disband in the near future? We also have Abu Mazen's age and health to consider here. Will there be a succession crisis in the near future? One of the attendees is asking. And then another question here relates to a recent report, a damning report on corruption within the PA, that that I'm not aware of the specific report that's being mentioned here, but some speculate that the prime minister could be, you know, take the fall for this corruption report and lead to the formation of a new cabinet. So just kind of touching on this issue of the immediate, in some ways, future of the PA. So we'll go first, maybe in the same order, Dr. Shikaki and then Dr. Jashan. Oops, you're muted.
Sorry. I was saying that the Palestinian Authority is not on the verge of collapsing or disbanding itself. In fact, if anything, the main driver, the main incentive and motivation of the current Palestinian leadership is self-preservation. It, most of the policies it is currently adopting are aimed at doing exactly that. So the Palestinian Authority will not disband itself. Any threat to do that, you should treat it as empty and meaningless. There is, of course, some demands among the Palestinian public for something like this to happen, for the PA to dissolve itself, that it has essentially failed in its mission to be the midwife for Palestinian statehood, and that with bad governance, there is really no need for it anymore. In fact, there is still, however, a small majority that is against that. And I don't expect this to change anytime soon. A succession crisis, absolutely, yes. That is certainly something that one would expect, because there are no rules right now, no written or unwritten rules as to what happens with regard to the leadership of the Palestinian Authority. When Abbas is gone, when we had a parliament before the president Abbas dissolved the parliament, when we had a parliament, the speaker would have become the interim president and elections would have been organized in 2 months after that. That is not feasible anymore. Both the fact that the president dissolved the parliament and the division between the West Bank and Gaza, with Hamas in control in Gaza and Fatah and the West Bank, makes that option simply not viable. And so without elections, the question becomes, whatever arrangement that might come about isn't likely to be seen as legitimate and to have credibility. That means there will be a lot of questioning of the legitimacy, continued questioning of the legitimacy, but also some internal struggle, whether that will become or turn violent. Hopefully not, but certainly one must not completely rule that out. On the question of corruption, our surveys again indicate that more than 80% in our last survey, 82% said there is corruption in the Palestinian Authority. The report that you, the questioner has alluded to, of course, is one that at this point isn't likely, Diana, to bring about a change in the government or to bring down the current government. That isn't likely to happen. This current government is the only government since the 2006 elections that is controlled directly by Fatah. This makes the current government more likely to resist any change, any reforms, and any attempts to try and meet the demands of the public. Only if there is external pressure that would be added to the internal demands will we be will we begin to see some change within the PA, among the elite of the PA, that would be responsive to the internal demands when and if there are combined with
Great. And I'll just turn back to Dr. Jashan briefly for a final word here on the future of the PA.
Realize we're running out of time. So briefly, let me just few words, elections are vital. There is no way to move forward for the Palestinians at all from this paralysis that I referred to earlier, except through democratic elections. The Palestinians, with the support of the international community, can administer and can hold democratic elections if they so choose. They shouldn't be giving Israel a veto power over any aspect of the elections. Like, let's say they are not going to allow the Jerusalemites to vote, therefore we will not hold the elections. No, we should hold the elections. Palestinians should have elections. You can even bring the whole, you know, population of Jerusalem over to the city limits and make sure that they vote. Voting is important at this stage to give legitimacy to the process, whatever that process will be. Change will not happen without them. The issue with the Nizar Banat tragedy, I think, is more comprehensive, a larger issue. The authoritarian tendencies of the security agencies in Palestine and their coordination with the Israeli agencies and having become a tool of the occupation has to end. Palestine does not need 12 or 16 or 18 security agencies, including naval intelligence in Nablus. I mean, there is no Navy in Nablus, so we don't need naval intelligence, whatever that is. I think one security agency is enough, and it needs to measure up morally and politically to the fact that the Palestinians are struggling for independence and are not an authoritarian state like the rest of states in the region. That require these types of authoritarian security apparatuses to suppress people. And finally, frankly, the fastest way to move forward in terms of reform, if Abbas, my advice to him, having known him for 30 plus years, 35 years at least, and having discussed things openly, there is mutual respect, at least on the personal level, okay, in spite of political differences, my advice is for him to own reform, to basically declare that he no longer wants to stay as president, that he wants to preside over elections, and he would like the following to happen: address the Palestinian people openly. If he wants to go down in history as a constructive, useful leader, he has to take matters into his own hands and lead the reform, because that is the shortest line between point A and point B. Short of that, he is going to remain an impediment rather than an agent of change.
Okay, well, I know we left many stones unturned here. Unfortunately, we are out of time, so we're going to wrap up here. But I want to thank everyone who posted questions. I'm sorry that we didn't get a chance to get to all of them. But thank you both so much for these insightful remarks. And I'll just turn things back over to Ron briefly.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Dr. Shikaki, Dr. Dashan, Dr. Greenwald. Thanks to everyone for joining us for this latest installment of Conversations with Israel and Palestine. Hope you enjoyed it. For those who missed the opening, I'll just say once again, Partners for Progressive Israel has just begun a matching grant campaign called Stop the Evictions. It seeks to rally attention to in order to help prevent Palestinian dispossession and displacement. So while today's program has been free, generous contributions are what enable the organization to deliver these events at no cost. So if you can, visit progressiveisrael.org. Make a donation, even if you can, check out the upcoming programming. So thanks again to everyone. Thanks to our panel. Stay safe and stay informed. Bye, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks, all. We could continue this for hours, I'm sure.